Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to the Western Hunting Hub podcast. Got a couple new discount codes I want to make you aware of. Hunting Hub is the coupon code for Working Athlete for 20% off, so make sure you get over there and get some of your Working Athlete just for your everyday use, but also for, which is also Wilderness Athlete, get some what you need for your hunts yet this fall. So get that coupon code Hunting Hub, put in that promo code box and get some savings there. And then also for the women listeners there out there, we're working with Ridge Patrol. And if you're a longtime listener, you know Drea has been a part of this podcast and she's a good friend of mine. So Ridge Patrol has given us 10% off. Go Clint10 is the promo code for that. So you can go get some women's clothing there. And I've seen the stuff. I mean, obviously not worn the stuff, but and I know the company, and they are focused on high quality gear. So go check that out. In this episode, I'm chatting with Justin Townsend from Harvesting Nature. We kind of focused on deer season. Deer season's coming or here for archery, coming up in November for the main rifle seasons, and wanted to just focus on a couple of recipes and things to do, ideas for your deer cut. So check this out. Great episode. A lot of really good a lot of good recipes and different things that Harvesting Nature has put out. They also have a podcast, so make sure you pay attention to that and enjoy this one with Justin. Hi, Justin. Thanks for jumping back on the Western Hunting Hub podcast. Enjoy having you last time, and have a nice little it's a podcast for me to go listen to later on, because it's got some recipes I want to and things we talked about last time that are good stuff. So I have to go back there and listen and write some of those things down, because I may have forgotten what we talked about. So but yeah,
all good, man.
Are you what's your fall been like? What have you been doing? What's ahead? What's going on?
So really, like, my fall season just kind of kicked off on Saturday morning. So I was up at the Front Range here in Colorado doing a bit of elk hunting, and then it was down so Sunday was down towards the Wet Mountains down south doing some elk hunting as well. Got in some good sign, but no elk. It's still pretty warm here, unfortunately, so I haven't been able to get as into the elk as I would like. But antelope rifle opener is this weekend coming up, and I'm heading down in the southeast part of the state and going to spend the weekend down there. And then in a couple weeks, I'm headed up to Wyoming for mule deer and antelope, and then November, I've got a trip planned with the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers and their Armed Forces Initiative, take some veterans out. And then I myself have a fourth rifle tag for elk. So I'm really kind of like all over the place.
Holy smoke. That's a busy fall. That's a lot of running around and hunts. So that's awesome. I'm really kind of jealous of a lot of guys. This is the first year I haven't elk hunted in a while, and it's been kind of tough. Watch, my boss brought a bull in today to work that it was on his way back through, and he shot a South Dakota archery bull, and it was like, oh man, it's just hearing the stories and everything on that just kind of sucks. I really hate not doing any of this. So next year, year I will, but it's hard to take a year off. I think of it this way. Kids that play whatever sport they play in high school, if you take 1 year off, you're like, I'm going to take 1 year. If you only have 4 years, in high school, and you take that 1 year off, that kid just about in every situation just removed the chance of a state championship if it's a, you know, I think a wrestling. Not many kids ever take a year off, never become a state champ. It doesn't happen usually. You have to have every single one of those years become a good athlete. Same thing with hunting. It's like, I just missed out in 1 year. I mean, I only probably got, I don't know, how many years of elk hunting in my life? I have no idea.
I don't know. I hope a lot.
Yeah, I know. But that's one that's gone. And I needed that. I needed that to learn to be kind of figuring things out in the woods, because you learn something every single year. And it's just bugging me that I'm not there. And he was explaining that. He's like, oh, just wait till you draw this tag. Just wait. He was in elk every single day, and it's just a riot. And just trying to get shot opportunities. Like, oh, I can't wait. But South Dakota, it's 17 years on average to draw this tag. So it's a...
Oh, man.
It's just one of those things you get to do. You get to do archery and then rifle, and then rifle out in the prairie, and the once in a lifetime is Custer State Park, and then Custer State Park archery. So those are, a lot of people go a lifetime without drawing that one. But yeah, so I definitely will be headed back to Colorado, headed to Wyoming, Montana in future years to keep learning, to keep having a good year. And I am rambling, but I do want to, this is probably a good year to not be hunting, because I did go get a report from my little honey hole where an outfitter just put his camp like literally in the middle of the trail where my elk, in between where I shot my elk died last year.
Oh man.
And because of that, he had like two hunters, and then there was a couple other hunters in there, and the surrounding outfitter was going into the same little area. So it was just kind of a zoo from what I was told. I met a guy in there, and then we just kind of text each other and say, hey, you going in? We both respect that we're going into the same spot. We're not talking each other out of it, but just nice to give each other reports. We pulled him out of the mud once, so he's been really nice about it. So maybe that's the year I just would have went and gotten skunk, because it wouldn't even have worked out. But that's just some lame excuse for me not elk hunting.
No, I think it's good. I mean, you bring a valid point. Like, that would have been frustrating to get up there and there's a spike camp in the middle of the place that you'd like to go.
Oh, I'd have been so upset. And so I don't know what to do, because my favorite time to hunt is right before the muzzleloader season. And I love that big opening weekend and all the way up to that. Seems like where I'm at, I get this little lull after a couple of days, and then it picks up right before the muzzleloader season. But maybe it's a pressure thing that I wait till after muzzleloader, but not like right after, because I just got pressured a ton trying to hit that peak rut time somewhere in there. Just, I don't know. I have to think about it. That later season is something I don't have a ton of experience of hunting. It's been always that earlier season. So anyway, yeah, there's thoughts on elk hunting plans and what I got going on. So, but I got you on to just kind of chat about some things that you guys at Harvesting Nature are doing, and then also thinking about November. We think about November, we think about rutting deer and eating them, of course.
Yeah, so exactly.
Yeah, what do you all have planned for how you remove your quarters, or how you debone debone the quarters to prepare for those meals down the road? Is there any things, because after you cut it, I mean, you can't put it back together. So is there a couple little things that you do specifically, either in the field or once you slap that quarter on the counter, to make sure you got some hunks for certain projects? Anything cool you're doing this year?
So I definitely, I think about it this way. Is first off, I don't always break down everything right away too. I definitely like to age it. I think we talked a little bit about it last time.
Yeah.
But I have actually I have from our wild pig camp that we did back in May. I've got a full pig quarter in the freezer still that I have yet to break down. And it's at the top of my list because I'm trying to get my freezer cleaned out. Obviously, you heard my schedule, and if it there's going to be a quick competition for space in it if things go according to plan. Yeah. But I would say that like there's not always a rush to do it. You know, there's a lot of conversation out there about thawing and refreezing, and I'm okay with doing it. So I'll thaw, partially thaw, process, and then refreeze in individual packages once I break it down. But one cool thing about breaking down and sort of some tips on freezer management is I always try to leave cuts as whole as possible. You know, steaks and things I'll portion out, but I'll specifically mark them and portion out usually 2 to 3 steaks a package, just because I know that's kind of what we make for a meal. And then if there's anything special I want to do with a cut, like say I take the tenderloins out, or, you know, I've got meat I want to make tacos with, or I want to braise it, or, you know, anything like that, I'll label it on the package, as I'm breaking it down. But I definitely always try to keep roast, try to break some steaks down. Also with that too, I also leave the silver skin on. I'm a big fan of that, following kind of the muscle lines and then trimming off the silver skin afterwards. I think that the silver skin helps protect some of the meat as it's in the freezer and reduces that chance of it getting freezer burned. Hmm. And if it does, it's kind of the silver skin that's getting freezer burned, which we're going to remove that anyway.
Yeah.
So,
and save a lot of counter time. My back just starts getting knotted up if I stand at the counter too long cutting meat. So
I'm the same way. I kind of gave up on the counter for that reason. And so back in New Orleans, when I first started cooking, I had a chef that was the same height as me. And I noticed almost immediately all the counter spaces in their kitchen were my size. I was like, this is great. Like, I don't have to bend over. And I was like, you know, one day I asked, he's like, that's it. He's like, you got to save your back if you're working over a countertop all. So everything was raised up to his level so he didn't have to bend over. And so versus I live in a rental house here, instead of raising all my kitchen cabinets, I built a processing table that's like half of it's wood, half of it's like starboard material. And that's what I use to process all my game on. Huh. So plus I put it on wheels so I can wheel it in my garage. I can take it in my backyard. I can bring it inside the kitchen, like kind of wherever I'm working that day.
Oh, nice. So, I had, and I just want to dive into some random recipes and things just to get some ideas going. I had made some sandwich meat, and I did a 10-day brine on this. It was a bear ham, but it doesn't matter. It's going to be deer this next time. And 10-day brine on it and injected it. So it was brining on the inside. It was basically, isn't that just curing it? Because I had some curing salts in there and everything. So once I got done with that and I smoked it for quite some time, it was really salty. What would I have done in that process? Like, how do you remove or get, you can't wash, you wash the outside. You're supposed to do that from what my directions were. But I guess from the inside, you can't just get that out of there. Like, any suggestions on how I could make a good sandwich meat again? Because I really like that process. Not necessarily have to be that same recipe, but you ever done that before? Is that's something you messed around with?
I actually have. So I had a similar instance happen to me. I made corn venison one time, and I used some curing salts. I didn't inject, but I let it set. I let it set over time and ended up same thing as like, hey, it's too salty. And I was like really, really frustrated because I was really set on this recipe. But so after that, I did a bit of research and I found out that there's like, probably one of the best ways is like you simmer it in some water, and a little bit of oil. Yeah. It sounds super weird, but that's like a good way. or you can just let it set in some water and kind of let some of that salt flavor kind of come out.
Sure.
It sounds super weird, but yeah.
No, I suppose because you have the salt on the inside, you have a concentration gradient. So the water's you're gonna have some osmosis going on where it's going to go from from low to high and dilute that salt. So I guess that makes sense. Or dissolve that salt.
I think definitely toying with, the curing process in general, I'm a big fan when it comes to when you start talking about sausage making and curing, instead of measuring, looking at recipes that deal in weight, because that's going to help you more accurately add into the correct ratios that you need.
Okay, sure. What was what you ended up doing after, just brining and then smoking and slicing? Is that kind of what you went with after that?
Yeah, so I brined mine, and then I actually roasted it in the oven, kind of just like you would, like a pot roast, not really like a braise, but just a bit of liquid in there. You can actually, I think it's up on the Our Harvest in Nature website. It's a corn venison. Yeah, so I got it on here. It's under Venison Reuben Sandwich, but it came out really, really well. Made a delicious Reuben sandwich for St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, there it is. I see it.
I love the
look of Reubens, but I hate sauerkraut.
Oh, man. See, so this one, have you ever made it yourself?
No. I dislike it so much that I...
Oh, man.
I don't even know I can make it. My wife loves it, but I would try it. I would try making it.
I mean, it's super easy. You slice the cabbage up and you put a bunch of salt on it and you massage the salt in there, and then it creates this juice that's basically your brine, and then you just refrigerate it overnight, and then it's edible. You just gotta eat it within a reasonable amount of time or it'll go bad. But that's for a quick version. But that recipe's in there. But I use the Morton Tender Quick in there, which I tend to find that it does leave things a bit salty. I like the pink curing salts is what I've switched to. And you can get that pink curing salt on Amazon and stuff too, pretty readily.
Yeah. So back to this injecting, I know that you didn't do that. Mm-hmm. What are some scenarios where people would inject a brine, or maybe you shouldn't? Because I did notice after I cut, it's like you can get that nice pink throughout, and then I can see just a couple little quarter-sized spots that I missed where that brine wasn't going to hit. And if I didn't inject it, I wouldn't hit any of that inside.
Yeah, and I think that's it. And you have to think about how long it's going to take for the brine to absorb in. And there's been several times I haven't gotten things cured all the way, and there's a little chunk in the middle that's still kind of that grayish color when you...
Mm-hmm.
When you've done, I think that curing it or injecting the cure does speed up the brining process or the curing process. So I think that it's okay. I think if you're working with a larger cut of meat, so say, in this one, I was working with a 4 to 6 pound roast, that's not a huge chunk of meat. But if you're I'm going to take this whole bear quarter and I'm going to, cure it, I would probably recommend injecting.
Okay. Yeah, because that's what I figured. It's huge. It's there's 6 inches across, 8 inches across, whatever it was.
Yeah,
it was not a big bear, but there was a lot there that I was like, "There's no way that's gonna get all the way in there." But So moving on from that, one thing I think is a deficiency in my cookbook repertoire is little chunk meat things, and that's just you always pull out there's hunks of meat in my fridge freezer that it says just hunk o' meat.
That's hunk o' meat.
I mean, I know my cuts and everything, but it's always like, that's just, I know that's something off the hind quarter. It's probably not a tri-tip, but it's probably a piece of a top round or the little extra 1 pound off of that top round, because I cut it into a more manageable size or something like that. But it's meant for that I can make jerky out of that, or I could make some stews, but my family doesn't do a lot of stews. So what kind of things do you have in your go-to for just having little cubed pieces of meat or chunk meat or just whole? It's not ground.
So if we're talking, are we talking like kind of like stew meat, or are we talking about like roast size?
Stew meat. Yeah. So stew little meat. Little cubed.
Ooh, perfect. I like making like meat pies with them.
Okay.
So you think like a stew, a thick stew, but with like a, you know, as a pie filling. And a really good one I have, a good recipe up on the website too, called deer and beer pie. So it uses like basically 1 to 2 pounds of cubed, 1-inch cubed meat. So that's perfect for those, like those odd bits you may have hanging around. And you essentially just kind of make like a thick soup, and then you can use cast iron or glass, and then you top it with either like puff pastry or that pie crust, and then you bake it, and it comes out really, really phenomenal.
I see that. Deer yeah. beer pie. Yeah, super flaky looking.
Yeah.
Crust to it. Huh.
It's pretty good. I think if you go over to our Instagram page and scroll down to the reels, there's like, when I made this, there's like a reel of me like cracking the crust with a spoon. It's just so like crunchy and delicious.
Very cool. What else? Like that one, I can see maybe, all right, we got some time, cause you get any pie takes a little more time. What else could we do? Something that would be every evening. We got some chunk meat that we need to, or cubed pieces that we would want to mess around with.
I think a good one's always stir fry, right? You know, people.
Yeah,
it's a pretty common one. I mean, you could really do a ton with various things. Here's another. We've got another good one on here. It's like chow mein. You like chow mein? Like kind of a, you think throwback to the like Chinese restaurant takeout dishes?
Yeah, I love a lot of Chinese, Asian, Mongolian, all that kind of stuff. Because I have a Mongolian dish that is, I just love. It's loaded with flavor, and that flavor is just in that meat, and it's. Through that cooking process, it's almost like you don't even have to worry about, I got to make sure this is exactly medium rare, because it's just little thin slices and it's just absorbing everything. And
yep, it
tastes really good.
So this one's, I really like, I've cooked a couple times. So Adam Berkelman, he hosts our Antler and Fin podcast, which is like kind of a recipe podcast. Basically mm-hmm. like gives you the origin of a recipe and kind of like walks you through it and all that. But he did this one, the crispy venison chow mein. And like I said, I made it a couple times. It's really, really good. And you do, just like you said, you have like this marinade where you're taking those either long strips or chunks, and you're putting them in oil and salt and cornstarch and kind of letting them get a good marinade. And it's something quick too, because as that's marinating, you go through and you put your noodles in to cook, cut your garlic and your ginger and make your sauces and mix all that together and get it ready to go. And so then when you're ready to like actually fry the meat, or saute it, then, you know, you can just like get everything together really quick.
Yeah.
So
and you're breading that meat and frying it in that cornstarch. Like it's coated.
So it kind of comes together in the marinade.
Got it. So like
you have it in the marinade. Yeah.
What? And I've seen this with that other Mongolian recipe. Why the cornstarch? What does that do versus just some flour?
Or is that so? Cornstarch is like a really great thickener. I think even more so than flour. But it also makes things super crispy. Cornstarch will get way crispier than regular flour will.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. I knew it was meant to, like, if I need to thicken something up, okay, you can do that. But I know if you add too much on certain recipes, it kind of gives it a weird flavor. But the crispy thing, I didn't know anything about. Okay. Well, what about... And I'm still working on, and I've done a lot of rib meat. The guy that invited me to bear hunt this September, we started butchering my bear, and he's like, "Oh, you want to make some bear bacon? Like off of the ribs?" And it could be a local term, but he was and sent me a thing of what a local guy had done. With that, but anything you'd like to do with the ribs or the slab of meat and slab of stuff that comes off of the outside of that, I deal with a lot of people that look at that and is like, look at this, there's stuff here. What could I do with this?
One great thing to do is almost like the rolled steaks. But you got this kind of big flap of meat, right? And I think it was one of the Meat Eater episodes, one of the latest season where Jesse Griffiths was on there, and they took, I think maybe it was Neil Guy, and he cut that exact flap you're talking about that covers the rib. He took that off and laid it out and then put a bunch of different seasonings and ingredients inside of it. I can't... remember exactly what he did, what the ingredients were, but I've done it where I've put like marinated red peppers. I've done I like using cheese curds because they have like a higher melting point than other cheeses. Put those in there with like chimichurri sauce and then roll it kind of all together and make kind of a pinwheel. And then you sear that on the grill or in a cast iron pan, and then you put it in the oven and you let it cook until it comes up to temp. And then once it's done, you just slice it kind of along the roll and you get that kind of cool pinwheel looking. I think an easy one's, it's like a common Italian one is like beef braciole. I'm probably butchering the pronunciation of that, but it's like the stuffed Italian beef roll is like kind of what it is. But that's a cool way to utilize that flap of meat.
I found it. Yeah, it's just like Texas style venison belly rouladen, something like that. But yeah, it looks really good in the end. But the thing I'm thinking about is you're making that and even popping a piece in your mouth and dealing with the tallow not solidifying on the roof of your mouth. Any tips for dealing with those cuts that really are a little gristlier, and it's not like dealing with a hunk of bear meat that it's okay to have that little bit of fat in there because it doesn't solidify on the roof of your mouth like venison tallow does. It sticks there. It just doesn't want you... Makes you not want to try it again. It's
a little waxy, yeah. I would say try to trim everything down as much as you can. And I think in that picture too, you can see him with kind of the silver skin there on the outside. And like if you wanted to remove that, remove as much of the fat as possible, and that's going to get rid of that kind of tallowy aftertaste or lingering flavor.
Okay. So my ribs that I've been doing, I'm really... My family just loves ribs. They love making pork ribs and just go nuts over some barbecue pork ribs. So I started looking at, well, I'm going to mess with my elk and venison ribs. And I would braise those completely submerged for, it was like 6 hours or so. And I haven't figure that out 100% yet, but sometimes you get that really tallowy taste and others you don't. And it's almost like you got to dump out some of that liquid because that stuff comes to the surface. And then I finish it on the grill with the seasoning and my barbecue sauce, just a rub in the barbecue sauce. And it seems to work out really well. But I do like to have some of that flap of meat, the stuff that's stuck on the outside, because you got multiple layers to it. It gives it a lot more consistent stuff, something to eat,
yeah,
versus that little slab in between each rib, because it's not enough. So I don't know.
Yep.
I don't know if you've messed around with that at all or tips for making ribs.
I don't always take the belly cut off, or that rib flap. I don't always take that off. I do like to leave it on there for the same exact reason you mentioned, but what I do with my ribs, I will actually take the ribs and I will just put a little bit of braising liquid in the bottom of a crock pot. Then I'll stack all the ribs. I'll season them however I want to season them. I'll stack all the ribs on top to where none of them are actually submerged in that braising liquid. And what that does is that allows, like, as that fat and tallow comes off, it drips down into that liquid and it doesn't stay on there.
Okay.
And then I do the same thing. I finish on the grill.
Okay.
And I'll do it with like barbecue sauce or whatever. But yeah, I put them in the crock pot for probably like anywhere from like 4 to 6 hours, depending on how much. But I take my ribs and I split them down the middle too, to make them a little more manageable to get into the crock pot. And then you get like smaller little packs of ribs.
Yeah. So that bottom rib, it's sitting on that bottom rib and that one gets a little bit more tallowy or.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you have to have some of them into the meat or into the braising liquid.
Yeah.
But you can do that. I mean, you can do it in the crock pot. I just do it in the crock pot because I feel really comfortable like leaving in the crock pot. Like I'll put them in before I go to work or whatever and then come back and they're there later and I know that they're going to be okay. Versus like you can also do them like in a Dutch oven, on the fire, the grill or smoker or whatever, to do the same process. It just like to me requires more attention.
Yeah. I like that idea. It's been a long time coming to trying something new on that and seeing if I can't get that tallowy stuff going. Cause it drives me nuts. I'm done with it. Sometimes it's almost like a gamble. I don't know if it's going to be that way or not. And it just turns me off for a while. Cause I'm kind of similar. I'll sometimes take it. Sometimes won't, just kind of depends on how it is. And especially you got a big bullet hole or something. You're like, yeah, there's like two back ribs. That's all that's there. Yeah. It's good. Just cause that coagulated blood just spreads all over the whole thing. But, okay. Shanks, I did something interesting the other day. I'd love to hear your critique on that. I threw 4 shanks into a bag and I threw a bunch of a taco seasoning in there with it. I don't know if that was necessary or not. But I sous vide it for 24 hours and probably not high enough temp. I did it for 135 degrees and then the last 5 hours I cranked it up to 145, something like that. And pulled that out and started shredding the meat off of there. Then I took it to the pan and added more taco seasoning because I didn't really taste a ton of that seasoning. It didn't penetrate it that well. So, and I threw that on some tacos. It was good. It was really good. I want to try it again, but what would you do different?
No, I mean, I think you're like really spot on with that. Did you put any other liquid in there? Any like butter or stock or anything in there with the shanks?
I just did the a little bit of water, just like I would make taco meat, but maybe a big glob of bear oil fat.
I think that would probably be good. Yeah, that would be good too. No, I think you're pretty spot on with like season it with what you like to go in there. And I I think as far as like absorbing the flavor, it's always really, really interesting how much, especially when you CV, how much it's going to absorb the flavor, because you're not getting a lot of loss. If you look at like other methods of like sauteing or braising or grilling, where you got juices and seasonings dripping off the meat. So it's always easier to play around with that too. I think with like, also with like shredded bits of meat, I always do the same and kind of like re-season them after, sort of to taste. I did a little bit different. I did another crock pot with a bunch of antelope shanks and used our harvested bacon blend, seasoned the outside, put them all into the crock pot, poured some beer in there and a little bit of pork stock, and then let that go for, I think it was about 8 hours as well as it works, and then came back and then shredded it all, and then I re-seasoned it, added some of the braising liquid back into it to give it a little more moisture, and then used that to make like Philly cheesesteak sliders. And holy smokes, it was great. Huh. But same exact process. I think just substitute the sous vide for the slow cooker or crock pot, whatever you want to call it. And I think you're not anywhere off by having to re-season and sort of like redo, add to it. Like I do that with salt all the time. I don't like to add a lot of salt into my initial preparation of a dish. Like I always kind of taste test at the end and see how the other flavors kind of pop and come out, and then decide like, do I need salt or do I need lemon or lime or like black pepper or something else? And maybe I can, you know, accentuate the flavor by adding another seasoning versus salt.
What about the temperature? Doesn't matter, sous vide or crock pot or whatever, for that low and slow, basically, stuff like that, that needs to let the stuff gelatinize or all that tendony junk, the stuff that you can't work around when you're wanting to pull that off in the processing. What's the best way to do that? Like really low? 'Cause I realized 135 was way too low. But 150 was going to be way too high to do that for so long.
I think so. Collagen and tendons and things like that tend to begin to melt at about 160. So that's when you get more of like a liquid gelatin versus, you know, sort of like that kind of gob of stuff that's in there. So I think if you want to do that, I would work towards that temperature. So maybe raise it up a little bit.
Okay. And that probably would allowed me to get a little more meat off of it, because I took the forks to it and I was like, oh, come on, let's shred.
Yeah.
I had to really kind of work for it.
That would definitely, get it there.
Okay. So if you were doing something easy with the shanks, I mean, we can obviously cut it off and grind it. That's one thing I always tell people, just an easy grind. Second would be just to braise it and have some shredded meat. Any other easy, quick things to do with that? Because I know cutting them in chunks is not so easy. Take a little longer.
Yeah, I know, to do like the ossobuco cuts and things like that. Like that's, you know, you're freezing and then cutting that way. I mean, if you want to get some good flavors too, like using shanks to like cook like beans or anything like that is always a really good option as well. Like smoking shanks and then putting them into something. Like I really like to make like pinto beans or red beans or anything like that. Like put shanks in there and let them cook as the beans are cooking. Gives like some extra added flavor.
Okay. I guess the next thing I was going to ask about was just some meat tenderness. I've noticed, like, say on the back ham, general rule of thumb, it seems like the closer to the bone, the tougher, and the further away, the more tender. It seems to be what a lot of those cuts are. And along that bone. I mean, you've got your bottom round sitting right up there on top. It's right next to it. But then you got, and away from it, there's the tri-tip and the top round. And also your shank is really close to the bone. Is there, I started talking, I just forgot what my main question was. but with that tenderness in that back ham, is there certain routes you're going to go with something that's a little more tender versus, say, a little tougher, like a bottom round? So top round versus a bottom round.
I mean, I think too, like cross cutting some of those, for steaks and stuff too, some of those rounds, does well too. 'Cause then you're cross cutting against the grain. And then as you cut it or eat it, it ends up more usable and a little more tender. Sorry, I totally like lost my train of thought like midway through.
No, I get that, because you got the exposed grains.
Yep. Sorry. Yeah, there we go. Back on it. And I think that's like, that's really important, is cross cutting, and then like using roast. Like I do like to use like that football roast, or exactly a roast. Yeah. Really, really enjoy that.
The sirloin. Yep. And how do you do a roast so it's not drying out? Because I just have never done your typical old roast, like a pot roast, like mom would make on Sunday after church, and it'd be ready there. I've never made one that hasn't dried out. What are you doing with that to keep it from getting dry? Because it's cooked all the way through. Everything else I cook is, almost everything else is medium rare.
Well, I mean, so you can approach it two ways. You either don't have to cook it all the way through and make more of like, you know, you could season it, sear it on the outside, and then put it in the oven and, you know, either wrap it or leave it open, but then like kind of check the temperature pretty frequently, and then, you know, cook to medium rare or whatever, and then let it rest and then slice it. So you could do it that way. So that's more of like less like a pot roast, more like a, you know, just regular oven roast.
Sure.
I guess would say if you're going to do a pot roast, I think the thing is not overcooking it and really finding like that point where it starts to sort of break down. And that's sort of a little time management with it. But once you get, you know, earlier we talked about sort of that 160 point where things start to kind of break apart and shred and do all that stuff. So like once you get above that, things get pretty dry pretty quickly, especially with game, because there's no fat to, you know, in like a beef roast or anything that you would use with a lot of fat in. Bear roast would be the same. Like there's more fat in bear than there is in elk or deer or antelope. And so you got to be really careful when you cook it to not overcook it. And so kind of I tell everybody, meat thermometer, like get in there and check it. Like, all right, I know it may take me 30 minutes to cook this, but I'm going to be checking it at, you know, maybe every 10 minutes, maybe every 15 minutes, something like that, just to like clue in closer to how the meat's acting to temperature so I don't overcook and dry it out.
No, that makes sense. Okay. And good old ground. We don't need to spend really any time on this, because ground is, oh, we just literally made a beef stroganoff, and it's killing me that there was beef in it, but I don't have any say in what the meal was for tonight. I didn't plan it, so I didn't make it. But any good things you've had recently just with some old ground that just surprised you, or you thought where it was just excellent?
Hey, you know what's a excuse me. What's a really good one is like, I like making egg rolls, and that's something that's kind of fun to get the whole family involved too, because you got to wrap them and stuff like that. But, on the vegetable side, like cooking the ground meat and then adding the vegetables in, you can really use like whatever vegetables you have on hand. to mix in there, and then just like put it into an egg roll wrapper, use a little bit of water, fold it, and then, you know, fry it. And you have some, like, I've met a few people in my life that don't like egg rolls.
Yeah. I didn't as a kid. I ate one today. No, I enjoy them. I enjoy them as adult, but it's funny that you mentioned that, because I just had one today. I would rather have had it with some wild game in it. That'd be interesting. I haven't haven't had such a thing. What about breakfast? What are some of the breakfast meals? And you've got a little teaser in your site here somewhere. I gotta find where that is again, but it just looks like some little game hash or something with some eggs next, over easy eggs.
Like,
I'm
on the recipe when, sorry.
No, go ahead. I am a breakfast nut. I love all kinds of different breakfast foods. And so just different ideas on, doing something with some for breakfast.
So that one, the picture that you're referencing is the venison heart hash.
Oh, sure.
And I really, really enjoyed that recipe. It came out. So I used, what did I use? I didn't use our seasoning on it, which I'll have to go back and retry that. But I used, Traeger has a prime rib seasoning, that I thought went like perfect for breakfast. And you just take one venison heart. And then using diced potatoes, which you kind of soak in water overnight, that helps get rid of the starch and lets them crisp up. Onion, pepper, jalapeno, garlic, and then some of that seasoning, and then some eggs, and you just put it all in a pan and just brown it. Well, you don't put the eggs in the same pan, but you do the hash in a pan. And man, oh man, that's I'm a breakfast guy too, and that's probably like one of my favorite ones. And if you like, I like to think of it too, is like, we always try to eat the heart first, but I definitely will freeze hearts and eat them later. And breakfast is such a great way to utilize it.
That's always been just cut it up in little chunks and fry it in some butter and have that pretty quick. But I like that idea of if it is a texture issue of that heart, which I get a lot from folks, is cutting it up a little bit more and adding all those other pieces to it, like the potato, and then a little egg yolk drizzled all over top from poking the egg would probably make
that. I think it makes it more approachable, just like you said, for people that have that texture issue, because it's just, you're getting little bites of it mixed in with everything else. So
right, cool. Well, moving on, I'd love to hear what Harvesting Nature has going on, and kind of what you guys have been working on lately, and just let's talk about some of that.
Yeah. So I think probably the biggest thing is, we've moved into the space of in-person, skills camps. Mm-hmm. So we had our first one back in the early summer down in Texas, where we did a wild pig hunting camp. And in that like 3-day period, we walked people through shooting, through put them out in the blind, had them hunting pigs, and then as they're bringing pigs in, we did butchering instruction. We divided them into two teams. Each team cooked dinner and did a cooking class with our chef. And man, it was just like, it was such a cool experience, because we had a very diverse group of people that had hunted all their lives, people that had hunted but only done archery and never shot a rifle, to people that were like completely brand new to hunting, and just got to enjoy and get down to the nitty gritty and just talk a lot about food. And, you know, we dispelled a lot about the edibility of wild pigs, and how people, you know, there's a lot of folks out there that'll claim like, oh, you can't eat wild pig, those are disgusting. And like, myself and Casey went ahead of the class a day or two ahead and shot pigs, and we used those pigs to feed everybody for the entire class. So we ate nothing but like pork the entire weekend, which was great. But it wasn't just like we had, you know, pork loin or whatever. Like we made rillettes with the head, which is like the shredded French breakfast meat. We did We did pate with the livers, just like tons of different stuff. Ribs. We did, you know, the loin grilled. We learned about the Denver steak, which is an awesome cut of meat. If you've never dove into it, I recommend looking it up and saving it next time, because it's often easily missed. And then, so we really expanded on that. And then next year we're looking to do two more pig camps. And then we're going to do a wing shooting camp in January, likely. We haven't decided whether we're going to do a pheasant one in the Dakotas somewhere, or we're going to do a duck, dove, and snipe down in Florida. And then we're looking to line up maybe a fishing one or spear fishing one in the summer. So,
gotcha.
But all those kind of focused around the same thing, about just education and food and learning and bringing more people into hunting and learning to eat better, I think is the fun part of it.
If you want to do something in South Dakota, I'll host it. I got for work anyway. We've got the space, the education classrooms, we've got processing area, we got it all, and it'd be free. So you want to come there and do anything, you're more than welcome. The only issue is it's got to probably be grouse, because on this side of the state we're mostly grouse, sharp tails. There are some places you can go and find a few pheasants, but fewer and farther between, kind of difficult. So,
oh, well, let's talk a little more, maybe loop Casey into it for sure. I think I'd be interested.
Yeah. Okay. There's your in-person things. Do you got people just kind of signing up to do those coming from all over, or that may be a little bit more localized? Who's attending that?
No, they're people from all over the country, Canada too, which is great. Like we have one spot open for our December camp. We haven't announced any of the other camps for next year yet. That's coming here probably in the next couple of weeks. But it's literally, we have people from California, from Canada, from Boston, from Florida, from Louisiana. Like everybody's just flying in or driving in to attend these camps. And I think it's, like I said, it's so awesome because everybody's got different experience levels and perspectives. It's just, it's so much fun.
I got to get to go to my buddies down in Texas, and he said, come on down sometime, maybe January, February, March. I'm not sure when we're going to go, but there's going to be something to shoot is the plan, and pigs are in there at some point. So I will do some research, and I'm kind of looking at maybe even just the Eat Wild Game cookbook. Maybe it's time to add another wild game cookbook to my shelf, because I have one main one that I like, and then just everything else that you find randomly gets shoved into a binder. But what else do you have there on the site? Just plug that for people to pick up from you guys, or
sure,
videos, or where can we keep educating ourselves? Because I see that you hear a couple ideas and it's like, okay, that's great, but I gotta go dive in somewhere.
Yeah, so if you want to dive in, like our epicenter of everything we do is at harvestingnature.com. So there you can get, we do weekly articles and recipes. We've got both, I mentioned earlier, the Antler and Fin podcast, which we run weekly, and then the podcast I host, which is the Wild Fishing Game podcast, which is very food focused, very technical, like technique. We talk with a lot of guests about various food aspects. And then we're diving more into video. We do have a YouTube channel. There's some stuff on there. We just started being featured in the Sporting Chef on Sportsman's Channel and the Outdoors Channel. So we have a segment on that show where you can see kind of us doing stuff too, tips, tricks, techniques, recipes, things like that. And then I think one of the biggest things that we've released lately is our spice blends. So we currently have we've got a big game spice blend. We've got an upland fowl spice blend. We've got a wild fish. And then soon to be released is our small game blend and a waterfowl blend. So these are all like really, really well tested. A group of us, probably like five or six, divvied up the spices that we thought would make a good blend, and then tested them all and came up with these really, really great, we call them chef tested, hunter approved spice blends, which go great. I mean, I've used them on a ton of things. They've been very, very popular. A lot of great feedback, and I mean, I've enjoyed them. So.
Have you guys done any more of those, like, video date night kind of things, or?
No, we moved away from the virtual cooking classes. We still have some of them available on the website, but we're trying to do more in person, and gotcha. I'm trying to coordinate some classes here in Denver, and maybe here in the near future we'll be traveling around the U.S. to do some cooking classes or some game dinners or something like that to kind of to start to get out there and interact with people more in person, because I definitely miss that.
Yeah,
and ready to get that back in full swing.
Yeah, you can't really interact with people on a YouTube video, but you're in no. person, and it's just the connections you can make, I'm sure, are well worth it and a lot more fun.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Well, very cool. Well, Justin, I want to let you get back to your evening and stay on here, because I want maybe ask another question or two, maybe see if make some plans or something. But anyway, sure. Yeah, want to appreciate you chatting with me a little bit, getting some ideas, and I'd be hungry if I hadn't just eaten supper. So there's a lot of really good things, and perusing the website, it's fun to see the cool recipes on there, and gets me motivated again to print some off, check out that cookbook and so on. And maybe thinking the Upland Fowl Blend and the Big Game Blend are probably ones, because I'm not good with birds. I need to challenge myself with some Upland stuff. Big Game is where I spend a little more time. So I'd love to try and mess around with that Upland Fowl Blend and see what it tastes like. So, but anyway, yeah, we already got harvestingnature.com plugged, and you had already mentioned Instagram as well. So I'll send everybody the links down in the show notes there. And again, thanks so much for chatting with me.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate it. To the land, but it ain't my ground. This is God's country.